Hello, everyone. You're listening to a podcast from the NATO Association of Canada. My name is Phil, and I'm a research analyst and former program editor of the International Business and Economics section on our website. I'm sitting here today with our section's main contributors, Brad, Neelam, Ross, and Megan, for a conversation about changes in the global economy. You can find their bios on this webpage below. We're going to discuss how recent developments in politics, society, technology, etc. might have long-term structural impacts for how our economy works and what Canada's place might be in all of this. We're going to start by me posing a question and everybody giving a couple-minute answers, and afterwards, in the next part of this podcast, we're going to have a more free-flowing conversation about what everybody thinks. The question today is, what changes are happening in parts of the world right now, or might be happening in the near future, that might have an impact on the global economy as a whole? Which factors do you see as most important, and why? Thinking about this, I wanted to take a couple minutes to just talk really briefly about an issue that I've been thinking a lot about, which is if Euroscepticism, protectionism, nationalism, and other emerging or re-emerging political phenomena, especially in the Western world, are threatening the existing economic framework that was created by the Bretton Woods institutions and what that might mean for the world. So for anyone who doesn't know, the Bretton Woods institutions are the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, and they were created near the end of World War II to ensure the financial stability of our world as globalization and trade were increasing and making us more interconnected and interdependent. A lot of its supporters have said that it ushered in an era of prosperity and development, but a lot of people are also saying that it's tantamount to neocolonialism, and it's a projection of American power onto the world, and both claims are true. It's really too complicated to talk about this in great detail. But basically, what I want to talk about is that I think the impetus to liberalize economies, which was undertaken first with the post-war reconstruction of Europe and with development in the quote-unquote third world, what academics now call the global south, is about creating a single global market to which all national economies are connected. And so it's about creating uniformity between different economies so that the particularities of different countries won't get in the way of a smoothly running global economy. That means trade liberalization, that means privatization, that means a whole lot of different policies that these Bretton Woods institutions have advocated over the years. But it has also meant a growing transnational elite, growing wealth inequality both between countries, but also within countries, even in developing countries, people's incomes are stagnating and national industries fail to develop. And so this model of global trade and global openness is now under serious scrutiny by a variety of social forces. You have anti-system leaders and candidates from different populist movements. You have Trump and Brexit last year. You have Marine Le Pen, who despite losing the French election this year, garnered a historic high vote for the National Front. You have nationalist and increasingly anti-democratic leaders in different parts of Eastern Europe and other NATO countries, such as Orban in Hungary and Erdogan in Turkey. And the popularity of these leaders reveals a tension between this Western model that was created with the Bretton Woods institutions of exporting a liberal version of capitalism and trade across the world, and also market stability. Because global markets sometimes actually favor anti-democratic systems because they will provide the stability to make good, solid investments. And the histories of especially Asian economies that are doing well, like South Korea, Singapore, and China, can definitely attest to that. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Brad, who's going to start with the first answer to this question, and we're going to rotate through everybody. So Brad, take it away.
Thanks, Phil. Let me start by saying that much of what we're going to cover here, I guess I'll leave to you guys for this segment. But what I was going to say is that what you just described, the liberal world order, the single global market, that the idea of trying to create that, that's the ideological foundation of that is has a shorthand called Fukuyamism. That's named after Francis Fukuyama. He's an American academic from Stanford University. And he became famous in 1989 for writing a an essay and later a book called The End of History, where he basically claimed that whereas the French Revolution marked the moment when liberalism became formalized, and that was represented the what he called the pinnacle of human ideological evolution in theory, the fall of the Berlin Wall, when he was writing this essay, demonstrated that liberal democratic capitalism was the best system in practice. And so he said those things were finally united, theory and practice. And Fukuyamism is important to understand because it provides the moral impetus for maintaining the global market system, liberal democratic capitalism, that you could also call Americanism or whatever, the model of the West. But it's come under strain in recent times because of the rise of China and Singapore, the Chinese model, authoritarian capitalism, as you mentioned, general Euroscepticism, as seen in Brexit, and the rise of illiberal democratic movements throughout Europe, Marine Le Pen, Viktor Orban, the Golden Dawn in Greece, who are essentially neo-Nazis, and some other far-right movements in Europe are challenging this openness through ethno-nationalist movements. So that's going to have pretty profound implications, I think.
Great. We're going to move to Neelam now.
Thanks, Phil and Brad. So what I'm most interested in is, and I'll be focusing on the global shift towards a more digital economy. And within this, a huge tenet of the digital economy is disruptive innovation. And so the digital economy isn't just about moving business transactions that would have occurred in person online, but it's fundamentally transforming and shifting the nature of these transactions. And it further involves a lot of economic innovations as a result. Technology significantly alters the way that businesses operate and has led to a lot of these disruptive innovations that we see. A really good definition I came upon from Forbes describes disruptors as completely uprooting and changing the way we think, behave, do business, learn, and go about our day-to-day. So this is kind of referring to the Airbnbs of the world, a hotel service that has no property of its own, or the Alibabas, one of the largest retailers in the world that actually has no inventory. And just kind of keeping with the theme of what we're talking with today, I'm going to really try to focus on China. Because there is a book written about disruption in China, which finds that because of all of the just the changing infrastructure and the changing policies when it comes to starting businesses in China, a lot of the entrepreneurs really have to embrace this ambiguity. And that leads them to come up with just more disruptive innovations that can really transcend a lot of the cultural barriers that something like Amazon is actually having trouble with in China. And within China, there's one specific social media service known as WeChat, which is kind of taking the world by storm. And it's something of a super app in China, which has yet to be replicated by the Facebooks, the Snapchats, and the Instagrams. And so, again, we're seeing that it's not necessarily the G7 or the largest economies that are really utilizing innovation in the best way possible. And this could, in the long run, really result in a significant change to the global economic world order. I'm just going to leave with one note about Bloomberg in 2015 created an innovation index with six different criteria. And South Korea actually came up as number one for the most innovative, having the most innovative kind of infrastructure set up and the most friendly environment for innovation within the country. US only ranked within the top five in one of the six criteria. And Canada, unfortunately, was just number 20. So we will likely be seeing a massive shift in the global economic world order unless these Western companies, unless the G7 is able to create a friendlier environment for innovation going forward.
Sounds great. Ross is next.
Thanks, Phil. I think the issue that strikes me as being of particular significance for the global economy in the future is a sort of blend of some of the social issues that you and Brad touched on, as well, actually, Neela, since you mentioned China. I think that it's also particularly relevant to the issue that I've been thinking about, which is shifting demographics. Simply put, the world is getting older, and that has pretty significant implications in different ways for the Western world and the developing world. In the early 2000s in particular, there was a lot of focus on what it meant to see the baby boomers getting increasingly old, while fewer and fewer Western populations were producing children at replacement rates necessary to sustain economic growth sufficient to pay for the aging population. In basic terms, the tax base is not growing fast enough to sustain and pay for an aging population. This is something that's not only a social issue, but also is accelerated by some of the changes in technology that you mentioned, Nilam. The fact that fewer and fewer people will have the kinds of work that we had in the 20th century as a result of technological change also mean that there will be a smaller tax base. In the developing world, this has slightly different implications. There are more children in countries like India, Indonesia, but fewer in China, where the population is actually aging rapidly. You'll hear a phrase tossed around about China that the country has a risk of growing old before it grows rich. So whereas in Western countries, there are wealthy, well-developed social safety nets that can be expanded over the next couple of decades as the populations age, in the developing world, those systems do not exist. So the challenge that those countries face is different. Stanford, a couple of years ago, published a survey suggesting that the Western world was facing the greatest challenge because its citizens could not afford to pay for all the older citizens. But last year, 2 years ago, there was a study in Oxford suggesting that really, although Western countries may have to make some painful policy decisions like raising the retirement ages, increasing social security contributions, doing the kinds of things necessary to expand the tax base, it should be possible to pay for older populations. In the developing world, that doesn't exist. And so those countries face a much more significant social and policy challenge to meet the economic costs of aging.
Great. And we're going to end with Megan.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, really interesting, you know, argument there. I agree with a lot of things with aging population. I am going to talk about the possible shift to Asia, though, in my analysis of this. And I think, in my opinion, the global political economy has a great possibility of shifting to Asia. And I think in a lot of ways it already has. For one, in many ways, China is gaining a lot of political control through their investment and trade and relationships in developing countries. You know, according to the World Economic Forum, China surpasses the U.S. in foreign direct investment by $60 billion U.S. dollars. And, you know, most of China's money goes towards infrastructure that helps transport valuable African resources to China. So it's not so much as roping developing countries into long-term debt with China, but rather could be seen as neocolonialism. I think as well, the U.S. is possibly losing its place as the rock that the world's economy was built on. Right now, I think the U.S. is relying heavily on China for political stability. And I think China is resulting in gaining a lot of power through that, having the U.S. to, you know, rely on China to subdue North Korea, for instance, here. North Korea has been developing missiles that will be capable of hitting the U.S., allegedly. And of course, there is also a huge threat that if the U.S. military does anything brash, South Korea or Japan will be under North Korean fire. So right now, the U.S. only has China as, you know, a peaceful option. And of course, China is North Korea's greatest ally and only real connection to the outside world. It is up for debate, but it's something like 75% of resources are coming from China for North Korea. So China does gain a lot of political control through these business relationships. Another important factor which signals a change that countries in favor for anti-globalization, you know, they may lose their place as economic powers. Right now, the U.S. is, the world's old powers, I guess, you know, the U.S. and Britain, are in a bit of a weird kind of unstable position, you know, with Brexit and Trump, more right-wing powers, as Phil mentioned and Brad. You know, this could signal some change. Of course, there will still be trade, but it is a unique time in history where this could signal a change of global political order here. You know, Trump's Muslim ban and talks of the Mexican wall, you know, last year, as well as Brexit, could be seen as anti-globalization tactics. And of course, globalization, debatably, and more fluid borders and, you know, things like that can make trade and economic gain for a country much more attainable, as well as the NAFTA deal. That may be a warning of a shift to Asia, you know, more trade to Asia. For Canada right now, as trade and to the U.S. is kind of a bit up in the air that talks about new tariffs being added, Canada may end up turning to China, which is also actually happening right now. You know, China is a very solid purchaser of Canadian resources, especially with the Trans Mountain pipeline that recently opened up and is being built. And that kind of opens up, you know, the Canadian oil from Alberta that can reach the port in Vancouver, and which makes our resources a lot more attainable for China.
Great. Thank you so much, Megan, and thank you all for providing those insights. We're going to come back with a few more podcasts in this series to discuss the different issues that have come up in a little more of a conversational way. And we're going to touch on a lot of different issues around globalization, political changes, innovations, demographics, everything else that our analysts have mentioned. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening.